From our culture, 100 years ago, when a man died, his wife wore black. That let the world know she's in mourning. Okay, so that's in different ages at different times, people express their mourning or their shock at grief in different ways. You know, so I said they were wealthy, and they did come to sympathize and comfort their three friends. That was the reason they came. So now they're sitting in at the end of chapter 2, they're sitting in a circle around Job in a trash pile. Job has nothing. He's covered from head to toe with sores. So he's gone from a high position in life to a low position in life.
Probably the lowest.
The lowest position in life.
With dust on his head.
Now, we're ready to begin the poetry. Poetry begins in chapter 3, but before we get to chapter 3, I want to make some things that make some observations here about what we know so far. And this is going to require a little repetition on my part. I apologize for that, but repetition is good. I worked for the Army for 35 years. And their motto was, when you present anything to an audience, you begin by telling them what you're going to tell them. Then you tell them. And then you tell them what you told them. And if you repeat it 3 times, generally your audience will get it. So let's focus on each of these 3 people. Job, come in.
Sorry.
Okay, we're going to focus on Job first, and then God, and then Satan. In the beginning, Job was a servant of God. God was pleased with Job. He was healthy and wealthy and happy. He was very blessed. After round 1, he had lost his wealth. He was grief-stricken. He had lost all of his children. But he still worships God. After round 2... he's lost his health. He's covered with sores from head to toe. He's sitting on a trash pile, scraping his sores to relieve the itching. But he still hadn't sinned. Satan was wrong about Job's character. So Job doesn't know why it happened to him yet. He never knows why, actually. But he hasn't sinned against God yet. If you look at God in this saga here, in the beginning he's pleased with his servant Job. He says there's nobody like him. After round 1, he's still pleased with Job. And it says in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 2, after round 2 here, Job has still not sinned. Okay? I think it's important for us to remember as we go through this that Job has gone from somebody that is healthy and wealthy and happy to someone who is in poverty and grief-stricken and very sick and suffering miserably, but he's still God's servant. Okay? He's still God's servant, and God is still pleased with him. Job doesn't know what happened. He doesn't know why it happened. But throughout all of this, Job is a pleasing servant of God. Nothing in God's attitude about Job has changed from verse 1 of chapter 1 to the end of chapter 2. And in fact, I usually say this for later in the class, when you're in the 8th or 9th class, but I think it's important for us to remember that at the end of the book, God still refers to Job as his servant. He rebukes Job for talking above his head, for he says, you've darkened my counsel by words without wisdom. But he doesn't accuse Job of anything. He calls Job his servant. Okay? I think that's important to remember. So, let's look at Satan for a minute.
Well, it's comforting to know that Satan isn't all-knowing.
Yeah. He was wrong, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you better be careful when you bet against God. Mm. You know, that's what Satan did. He bet God that he would curse him, Job would curse him to his face, and he didn't. Satan, the father of lies, is the accuser of mankind, and he accuses Job. He says, Job will curse you to his face. He loses round one, so he ups the ante. He'll touch him physically, and he'll curse you to your face. Well, he loses round two. And we would like to think, at this point, that Satan would shut up and go back to heaven. I mean, he's been defeated, right? But no, he's not. He never quits. We'd see in chapter 2, verse 9 and 10, here's Job's wife. Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. That's exactly what Satan's trying to get Job to do, you know.
Did Satan make her do that?
Well, there's theories of that, you know. Why didn't he kill her when he killed his 10 kids, you know? But maybe she was more valuable to him as an asset to discourage Job, you know. But anyway, she is, I think Satan is working through her to try to get him to curse God and die, you know. And we're going to see the three friends, I think, really come to comfort Job and sympathize with him. That's their intended purpose. But they wind up tormenting him with all kinds of accusations. They don't want him to curse God and die, but they want him to admit that what has happened to him has happened because of his sin.
Yeah.
They want Job to say, boy, I must have really done something bad. Let me find out what it is so I don't have to do it again. Please take the suffering away, God. But Job holds on to his integrity throughout all of this. And he gets downright argumentative or angry with God. He gets real frustrated. But we've got to remember the condition he's in when he does this. We kind of tend to cringe a little bit at some of the things he says to God. And we kind of defend his three friends because they're defending God. You know, and we'd like to defend God too. So, let me get where I am in my notes here.
Since we're ready for the portrait.
Yeah, we're ready to go to the portrait.
Just to note that, you know, we are, those of us who have children, and they got through the teen years without us having to execute them in our anger because of how they smart off and whatever. We don't stop loving our kids, and I don't think God stops loving us when we are completely human, even at our worst. I mean, that's why Christ died for even the worst among us. So I just think we don't want to do that, but we don't need to fear that God's not going to ever understand or be forgiving of us if we have the right attitude to Him.
Yeah. I think when you're in a condition Job's in, God is understanding when you cry out in anguish and you want to know why.
Because Jesus had to cry out in anguish himself, so he certainly understood it.
We read in chapter 2, verse 3, God says that even though he's ruined Job without reason, Job still clings to his integrity. And later in that verse, in that chapter, in verse 9, Job's wife says, are you still clinging to your integrity? I want to tell you what I think that means. How was Job clinging to his integrity? I think he does it three ways. First, in the face of disaster, he never curses God to his face. Okay? That's the first thing he does. And he, you know, that's verse 10. He says, "Are you you're talking like a foolish woman? Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" So he doesn't curse God, and he doesn't deny that God exists, and he doesn't believe that God is an evil God. But he's very confused. He doesn't know why God's doing this. The second way I think he holds on to his integrity is He never admits that this is happening to him because of something he did to displease God. He clings to his integrity in that way. Okay? You know, I think a lesser man might say, boy, what did I do to deserve this? Have you ever heard that? When somebody, something bad happens, what did I do to deserve this? And you start looking for a cause in yourself for why this has happened to you, and it's not there. So he does that. And then the third thing that I think he does is he keeps on doing what is right, what he knows to be right from God's word. And you're going to see this issue of his integrity comes up several times. Early he says, my integrity is at stake here. You know, and I wish God would just kill me now so I can have this comfort that I have not forsaken the words of God. Something to that effect. We'll read it in a minute. But three things. He doesn't curse God. He doesn't believe that it's his fault that he's suffering like this. And he says, I'm just going to keep doing what's right until I know different. You know, I'm going to keep doing what God has revealed to me. So that's what I want to do. I'm not sure I'll be able to do that, you know, when disaster strikes. And, you know, we said last week, well, this is a pretty old class. We've had enough of life that we know that disaster's coming, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be part of our life. When it happens, I want to not curse God, not look for a reason, unless it is overwhelmingly obvious why. You know, I'm not going to look for a reason for my sin, and I'm going to keep doing what's right until I die, okay? And I say unless it's obvious. I'll give you an example. I could drink alcohol for 10 years, get drunk every night, then start suffering and go to the doctor, and he says, you've got cirrhosis of the liver. I'm not going to ask God why this happened to me. I'm going to know, right? I don't know what I did. So, but if I don't think I've done anything, I'm not going to try to manufacture something that I did to blame it on, okay? So, let's read chapter 3. We're starting the poetry, and we talked a lot about, for those that weren't here last week, we talked a lot about the nature of Hebrew poetry. It's not rhyming words, it's rhyming thoughts. And so we're going to look for the poetry as we read this. But I will start, and I'll read, say, through verse 10. And somebody else read maybe down through verse 19, and then somebody else finish the chapter. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, May the day of my birth perish, and may the night it was said a boy was born. That day may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it. May darkness and deep shadow claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May darkness overwhelm its light. That night, may thick darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year, nor entered in any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shout of joy be heard in it. May those who curse days curse that day, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. May the morning stars become dark. May it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of dawn. Okay? Somebody read the next 10 verses.
Where did you stop?
Verse 11. Okay. Read down through 19. 11 through 19.
Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breasts that I should nurse? For now I would have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built ruins for themselves, or with the princes who had gold who filled their houses with silver? Or why was I not hidden like a stillborn child, like infants who never saw light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners rest together. They do not hear the voice of the oppressor. The small and the great are there, and the servant is free from his master.
Okay. Somebody finish the chapter.
Why is light given to those in misery, and life to the bitter of the soul? To those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than for hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave. Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For sighing comes to me instead of food. My groans pour out like water. What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil.
Okay. You see the poetry, the couplet, the second line echoing the first line? So Job, after 7 days and seven nights, he speaks and he comes out swinging. He's bitter. He spends ten verses here cursing the day of his birth. Starting in verse 11, in anguish he asks why. There are four or five rhetorical questions here. Why? Why did I not perish at birth? Why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child? Why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Rhetorical questions. I don't think he's looking for an answer from his friends, and I don't think he's looking to get in a theological debate with them about why, okay? But he is suffering. And I don't think at this point he's really addressing God yet. You got to pay attention as we go through the poetry. Sometimes he's talking to his friends, sometimes he's just talking, and sometimes he's addressing God directly. And we got to make sure we understand when that happens.
You know, at these questions, I believe he's justifying why he's feeling this way.
You feel he? I don't think he knows why. You think he's justifying why?
Yeah, I think he's just, he's giving examples of why should I be, why should I be.
Well, yeah, well, but he says, why should I be suffering? I mean, why should I still be alive? He wants to die. He wants death. But he can't get it. He's longing for death because he's suffering so badly. I've never considered that he's justifying himself in this, but he certainly is suffering, and he is certainly asking why God. Now, and he's asking not just about himself. He says, God, why do you do this to everybody? why is there so much suffering in the world? And why do people stay alive when they long for death? They welcome it when it comes. So
my next question is, what's the point? What's the point of people just suffering?
Right.
I mean, here I am suffering. Why can't I just go home and be with my fathers or whatever? However he might express that, but it doesn't make any sense just to be here to suffer.
Right. I think that's true.
He's so miserable, he wished he had never been born.
Right. A good way to put it, yeah. He says at verse 25, what I feared has come upon me. And I think what he's feared is exactly, he's hopeless. He sees no hope of ever having a life again. He only sees the rest of his life as going to be suffering and misery, and he's feared that all his life. I tried to turn that down, John. I don't think I got it.
No, nope, you didn't.
You're going to have to teach me how to use that thing. Put it on 70.
I'll put it at 67.
All right, that'll work.
You go, Johnny, you go.
Then some of them will be freezing. I'll feel great.
I don't think we'll be freezing.
I wouldn't.
We may have a problem because that fan
Have a little mercy on people. Let's take that.
John, I didn't hear the fan kick on when I
The door.
We can open the house out door. It's nice outside.
We can get a breeze through there.
Yeah, it was on. It was 75 in here, and it was on 70.
Okay, we got a problem. Then this, because it's
John,
if that door would stay like that,
okay, leave the door open. That'll help.
Too much.
Yeah, we feel the
Nothing is going to hurt it right now.
Where's the shots are holding?
Yeah, there was a door shot.
It's back there.
Oh, here it is.
No,
that's just a stopper.
I'm sorry for interrupting. I didn't hear it. I heard of it. Just heard about it.
Rock the chair in the door.
Yeah.
Let's do this one.
A pause here for a maintenance.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'll try to.
Turn it the other way and I'll sit in it.
There you go.
Alright. It'll work too.
I was gonna suggest that John could just hold it.
Yeah, John should stay in there.
Okay. So the debate really begins when Eliphaz tries to correct Job's attitude. Okay, he tries to give him some advice. And I think that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are probably horrified at his blasphemous, rebellious asking why, you know. I believe they maybe were expecting a more humble Job, a servant. I mean, you know, they're accustomed to seeing Job the servant of God, and servants of God don't cry out in God's face, why? Okay? So they think, we're going to see that they think they know why Job is suffering. Okay?
That's arrogant too.
Yeah. They think they understand exactly what's happening to him, and they try to get him to agree with them. And the harder they try to get him to agree, the more Job bows his back and resists it. And they become not a comforter or a sympathizer with Job, but an accuser of Job, just like Satan. So let's look at chapter 4. And I love the way Eliphaz begins. You know, we said they were all probably younger men than Job, because they sit respectfully around him for 7 days and seven nights waiting for him to speak. And Eliphaz is probably the oldest of the three men. At the end of the book, God addresses Eliphaz for the three of them. So he's probably the oldest of the three, and they're all three younger than Job. But this is almost comical the way he starts. He says, if someone ventures a word with you, would you be impatient? You know? But then he says, but who can help but speaking? You know? Then he begins to just dump on poor old Job here, you know? So let's read this chapter and we'll go back and discuss it. And again, let's do it the same way we did. It's 21 verses, so if we can read about 7 verses apiece. And let somebody, I'll read one time, but if somebody can read the first 7. Okay, Tim.
Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered, if one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient? But who can refrain from speaking? Behold, you have admonished many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God and your confidence and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright destroyed?
Okay, I'll read the next 7. As I've observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. But the breath of God, by the breath of God, they are destroyed. At the blast of his anger, they perish. The lions may roar and growl, yet the teeth of the great lions are broken, and the lions perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lionesses are scattered. A word was secretly brought to me. My ear caught a whisper of it amid disquieting dreams in the night when deep sleep falls on men. Fear and trembling seized me and made all my bones shake. Okay, somebody finish that for the end of the chapter.
A spirit glided past my face, and the hair on my body stood on end. It stopped, but I could not tell what it was. A form stood before my eyes, and I heard a hushed voice. Can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? If God places no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who live in houses of clay, whose foundations are in the dust, who are crushed more readily than a moth? Between dawn and dusk, they are broken to pieces. Unnoticed, they perish forever. Are not the clouds of their tent pulled up so that they die without wisdom?
Okay. So, what do you see here? What is Eliphaz trying to do? Anybody?
He's not helping any, I know that.
He's not helping Job at all, is he? He starts out, he says, look, Job, you've comforted people when you've seen them in the shape you're in now, and now you're there, and you're just falling apart. You know, follow your own advice, Job. It's what, and then he says...
But I bet they hadn't seen anybody where everything's taken from them. All
right.
Their children,
yeah.
All their wealth, and then sores all over them.
Right.
So I think he's being kind of ugly.
Yeah, he's definitely insulting Job.
Yeah.
And it gets worse. He says, gives him some advice. Your piety should be your confidence, and your blameless ways your hope. You know, hope. Job said, "I don't got no hope." Eliphaz says, "Hope in God. He'll, because you're of your piety, he'll straighten you out." And then he says, and this is the essence of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar's argument throughout the poetry. He says, I've observed that those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. That's, you're in trouble, it's your fault. That's what he's saying to Job. Then he goes into a little soliloquy here about lions. God can deal with lions easily enough, you know, so he'll straighten this out for you if you'll just appeal to him, you know. Then he raises this issue of what I know was revealed to me at night in a vision.
Oh.
You know, I don't know if you believe that or not. You know, I don't believe that. But he said, and what is revealed to him is in verse 17, can a man be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? What he's saying is, Job, quit trying to put yourself on a level plane with God. Just be submissive to God. So he says, you know, God doesn't hold his angels or his servants innocent. He charges them with error. How much more is he going to charge mankind? So that's the fourth chapter. Any other comments or observations about that chapter?
Yeah, William. I think it's like everyone has a philosophy of life and why things happen. Even if we haven't thought it out, we have that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm seeing here is like there are some things that I agree with him, and I think the Bible even agrees with him. Like Paul said, you reap what you sow.
Yeah.
And that's what he just said.
Yeah.
You know? And so that is true. That's a true statement. But I think where we mess up is when our philosophy, when God works outside of our philosophy, we think God has to work within these, but we reap what we sow.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bible, we show in the Bible, see, that's what the Bible says.
Right.
But then
someone doesn't reap what they sow, and we don't know what to do with that. It's like, hold it, I thought God said this, and that's not happening. And I think one of the lessons I get from Job is that God isn't restricted to a particular, he's beyond a human philosophy. There are certain things that are true in theology, philosophy, mm-hmm. whatever, but God is. But we can't put God in that box.
That's right.
Outside that box.
Yeah.
And so sometimes a person doesn't reap what they sow, and sometimes someone reaps something really good that they didn't sow.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of variables there, and then sometimes someone reaps what. And so Eliphaz is saying, "Look, this is. I'm telling you what I've seen."
Yeah.
And that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is true. But in this case, it's not true.
Yeah. Like I said, we want to kind of sympathize with Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, because they're defending God. Mm-hmm. They're doing their dead level best to defend God. Mm-hmm. But they're wrong. Mm-hmm. And Job is crying out in anguish at God, and we kind of cringe at how close he gets to disrespect. But remember, at the end of the book, God says to Eliphaz, "My servant Job has spoken what's right, and you've spoken what's wrong." And we'll have to get into that in more depth later, because you wonder, Job said a lot of things wrong, but God says he spoke what was right. And the Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they say a lot of things that are right, but God is angry with them. And we're going to explore why. What specifically did Job say that was right, and what explicitly did they say that was wrong, that was displeasing to God? But yeah, we'll talk about that a lot in later classes.
I think there's probably another truism that goes with those that Alan was referring to, is that sometimes we reap things that we didn't sow.
Yeah.
People can do things of their own volition to harm us, or inconsequentially to what they intended, it does harm us. Mm-hmm. And that's not something we've sowed necessarily. We might be tied to that, but we may not be tied to it at all.
Yeah, be sure, about the fourth or fifth lesson that I've got in this material on Job, I've got an explanation of that. That is really good, because I call it EBZ theology. And what's wrong with EBZ's theology? And it's throughout the Bible. It's not just in the book of Job. You see it in the Gospels, where they say, "Was that man born blind because of his sin or somebody else's?" And Jesus says, "Neither one." Okay? So I think this is a false doctrine, that a lot of Christians hold. And it's wrong. It's wrong to believe that because I'm a child of God, he's going to protect me from suffering, and he's going to punish all the wicked people. We don't know why God does this. We've got to walk by faith, and when we get to heaven, maybe further along we'll understand, right? We sing that song. But don't assume that all the blessings you have are because God's pleased with you, and all the curses you see on others is because God's displeased with them. Or when you come under hardships, don't assume that it's God's punishing you. That's the big lesson, I think, of Job. Okay?
Your comment reminds me of the prosperity gospel. You know,
right.
Where they pretty much teach that, you know, if you're good with God, you're going to have material blessings.
Yeah.
And if you're not, you're going to...
Yeah, I've got about a two-hour documentary on the prosperity gospel that is really good, if anybody cares to listen to it. It's done by the evangelical churches that are speaking out against some of these claims that televangelists are making, you know, to get money sent to them. But the name of it?
I said that's the main aim of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you'll get blessed if you send money to my
grave. Okay, we're ready for chapter 5. And let's read it. It's just a little longer. It's 27 verses. Maybe four people read. What would that be, 7 verses apiece or something? keep looking for the poetry. I'll read first if you want me to. Call if you will, but who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Resentment kills a fool, and envy slays the simple. I myself have seen a fool taking root, but suddenly his house is cursed. His children are far from safety, crushed in court without a defender. The hungry consume his harvest, taking even from among thorns, and the thirsty pant after his wealth. For hardship does not spring from the soil, nor does trouble sprout from the ground, yet man is born to trouble as surely as the sparks fly up. Okay? Somebody read the next 7 verses.
As for me, I would see God, and to God would I commit my cause. Who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number? He gives rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty, so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noonday as in the night.
Okay.
He saves the needy from the sword in their mouth. He saves them from the clutches of the powerful. So the poor have hope, and injustice shuts its mouth. Blessed is the man whom God corrects. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but his hand also heals. From 6 calamities he will rescue you, and 7 no harm will befall you. In famine he will ransom you from death, and in battle from the stroke of the sword. You will be protected from the lash of the tongue, and need not fear when destruction comes.
Okay.
You will laugh at destruction and famine, and need not fear the beasts of the earth. For you will have a covenant with the stones of the field, and the wild animals will be at peace with you. You will know that your tent is secure, and will take stock of your property and find nothing missing. You will know that your children will be many, and your descendants like the grass of the earth. You will come to the grave in full vigor, like sheaves gathered in season. We have examined this, and it is true. So hear it and apply it to yourself.
Okay, so he starts out by saying, basically, nobody agrees with you, Job. You know, nobody thinks the way you do. You're a fool. You're a simple fool. Okay? And then he says, I have seen myself that sometimes it looks like the wicked are beginning to take root, but it's only temporary. God's going to sweep them out of the way before it's over. So then he comes back to Job. He says, there's a reason for your suffering, Job. You know, it's you. You're the reason for the suffering. He says, hardship doesn't spring from the soil, and troubles doesn't sprout from the ground. So it's Job's, the source of Job's suffering is Job. That's what Eliphaz is saying to him. He gives him some advice in verse 8. If I were you, I would appeal to God. I would lay my cause before Him. In verses 9 through 16, he praises God, and he sounds just like a psalmist. All that God is capable of doing and will do, you know. So that's what we want to agree with Eliphaz. Verse 17, he gives him more advice. Just accept God's discipline. It's a blessing to you. I'm like, can you imagine how ridiculous that is? Here's Job covered from head to foot with painful sores, and here's Eliphaz standing in front of him with a robe and says, how blessed you are that God is disciplining you. That's not going to help Job at all, is it? So notice that in verse, he's talking about he calls him the fool here, but it's the wicked man. It says, verse 4, his children are far from safety, crushed in a court. The hungry consume his harvest, the pant after his wealth. That's exactly what's happened to Job. Job has lost his children were not saved. His wealth was not safe. He comes back to that over in verse 24. He says, "You'll know that your tent is secure. You will take stock of your property and find nothing missing." Job's lost it all. He can't take stock of his property because he doesn't have any anymore. So there's got to be a kick in the gut for Job to be told this, you know, in his suffering. "You'll know that your children will be many." Well, he's lost all 10 of them. Mm-hmm. So it is really ridiculous to see Eliphaz berating Job and Job in the condition he's in. Okay. Let me see where I am here. In the interest of time, I'm going to jump over some of this. Got something I want to say here. And I've got to find it in my notes. Okay, the debate is really on now. Job is not going to buy into anything that the three guys are saying. He's going to bow his back and contend with them. I want to share something with you here that I think we need as Christians to keep in mind. And I wrote it this way. I said, Christians are people of the book, aren't we? We study the Bible to understand how God works. We study the Bible to understand our relationship to God. And often we see, when we read accounts in the Bible, that God will, the inspired reader tells us what God's going to do and why. He even tells the people involved what he's going to do and why. And sometimes it is because of their sin. Okay? A couple of examples. Eli, the priest of God, he's at Shiloh where the tabernacle is. The Ark of the Covenant was there. And he had a young child named Samuel with him. One night, Eli had two wicked sons. They're serving as priests, and they're disgraceful. Their conduct is disgusting. But Eli doesn't discipline his children while they're priests of God. It's not just like me disciplining my child. This is the priest of God that needs discipline, and he's the high priest, okay? the priest. They're all descendants of Levi, I guess. So he doesn't discipline his son, and one night, God speaks to Samuel, and he told him what he was going to do. And he told him why he was going to do it. Disaster is coming on Israel because of Eli's sin. Okay? In the course of time, Israel goes to war with the Philistines. They take the Ark of the Covenant to the battle and they lose it. They lose the battle and the Ark of the Covenant is captured. And the glory of God has left Israel. Okay? It's one example of where God said, "I'm going to do this, and this is the reason," and then it happens. David is another example. David was the anointed king of Israel, but he committed adultery with Bathsheba, and then he had her husband killed when she became pregnant. God sends Nathan to David to explain what's going to happen because of David's sin. The child died. David has trouble with his children the rest of his life. One son rapes a daughter. The same son kills another son and then rebels against David and tries to take the kingdom away from him. God says you're going to have trouble with your kids all your life because of your sin with Bathsheba. So here's two examples where God says, "I'm going to do this for this reason." And so the inspired reader tells us why, and he tells David and Eli why. So we begin to think that God's going to do that. God's going to tell me when trouble comes to me and what sin I committed so I can straighten it out. But God doesn't work that way in general. That's not the norm, is it? In general, God is mysterious, God is sovereign, and he's not answerable to us, and he is not required to tell us why, okay? And we need to keep that in mind. So let me see where I am here. Job comes along. Job, God doesn't tell him why. Disaster strikes him, but he doesn't know why, and he never knows why. You know, I told you about the poem that was written by Robert Frost, The Mask of Reason, where it's a continuation of the book of Job, where Job and his wife and Satan and God are talking 1,000 years later, and Job still wants to know why, you know? And God still doesn't tell him why, you know? God. So we have to realize that we need to let God be God, and we need to walk by faith. And if we're going to lose our faith when bad things happen, we have a very weak faith. Okay? So, let's see where I am, because I told what I wanted to tell you, but not according to my notes. Okay? Remember this, too. The sin that for Eli and David, that affected the whole nation of Israel. And they never knew why. The inspired reader tells us why. But I don't think David went out and said, hey, God just told me I'm having trouble with my kids for the rest of my life. Or when the army goes to war with Eli's time, they didn't know why they lost the battle and why the ark was lost. So God doesn't tell a lot of people when he tells them things. Just two people.
I heard a good lesson once by Earl Winter on the radio. His point was, one of his points was that God's tolerance, or I should say long suffering, is not his tolerance of what you're doing. Yeah. If we're sinning, his long suffering is so that we will stop, not that it's not a testimony that it's okay.
Yeah, and that's what the scripture is. He wants everyone to repent, right? He wants everyone to be saved. Okay, so
I just think it's okay.
I'm sorry?
I said we've become complacent thinking it's okay that we keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah. David and Eli, and I want to defend these two guys because they're men of faith. Both of them are men of faith. And I love the way they responded when they got the news of what God was going to do. Eli, when Samuel told him, Eli says, he is the Lord. Let him do what's right in his eyes. To me, that's a statement of faith. That's the kind of attitude we want to have. David, when the child died, he got up and worshiped. And this was immediate. You know, it was the day the child died. He'd been mourning, praying, fasting to get God to let the child live. When the child died, he gets up and worships God. Now that's faith. And I love what David says, because I think it is a good indication of life after death. He says, you know, child is dead. He says, the child cannot come to me now, but I'll go to him. A beautiful statement of faith, and I love that. Okay, so let's find out how, let's see, well, we're out of time. We'll have to start with chapter 6 next week and find out how Job responds to Eliphaz's rebuke. So, yeah, we're out of time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And Kim, I'll say a word.